If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It's David. It is the podcast time. We're trying to look at the world and make sense of it from an economic angle, and the world is weird. How are you, my mate? Are you good?
I'm good. I'm very good. Let me tell you what happened to me last week.
Tell me what happened to you last week.
It was Cheltenham week. You know, I'm
are
not
you into the horses.
Not really. Not really. But you know, we know a lot of horsey kind of people.
We know a lot of people who gamble. That's who we know. A lot of people.
Okay.
Horsey people are quite different to fellas who spend a lot of time in bookmakers.
Well, I'm referring to Pob. Peter O'Brien.
My cousin.
Your cousin. Shout out to Pob.
Shout out to Pob in Australia, whose first job was, I'll tell you in a little minute.
Yeah, that's actually quite a good one. But he's manages that stud.
He used to manage Coolmore, wasn't it? That's the big
Coolmore,
one.
Coolmore, yeah, but he's moved into another stud. Anyway, he sent over a whole load of tips for Cheltenham. So I kind of went, why not? And I have a Paddy Power account. So I was kind of picking out the horses.
By the way, should we be saying that somebody who works as an insider in the industry is sending over tips for Cheltenham?
Oh, that's done all the time.
Is that what they do?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what they do. But, you know, Pob is maybe a 50% success rate, you know.
That's quite good.
But I so happened to pick a lot of his horses and a lot of them came in, which was fantastic. So I was chuffed at myself.
Good for you.
I was up about 180 quid. And these are all on like 5 quid each way bets. I was absolutely going fantastic. Anyway, so I was leaving the office and went up to jump into the car.
We're clamped.
I was clamped.
All your winnings.
All my winnings went.
Oh, no.
So my mood went from way up there, woohoo, down to, oh, Jesus.
Well, the funny thing about being clamped, that brings us nicely, and we're going to talk to Simon Cooper in a couple of minutes about the price of parking. Okay.
Exactly. There's always a link, Mike.
There's always a link. There's always a link. Speaking of the price of parking, do you know what arrived today in Dublin Port?
What?
The Vespa.
Oh, did it?
We've now got paperwork to do, right? Because of the Brexit.
They've got all
the paperwork to do, right?
So you probably won't get it for another month.
Well, you remember you started with Bat Out of Hell last week?
Yeah.
Your man is Harley Davidson. Next week, it's going to be Mac Out of Hell on the Vespa.
Quadrophenia.
Exactly. Here we go. Ace Face. Down in Brighton or Tremor. Anyway, so you're in good form apart from winning.
Apart from that, the highs and lows.
The highs and lows, you know, you win some, you lose some. You know, I don't get horse racing at all.
Yeah.
I really don't get it. But Pob, my cousin's first job, I think he was talking to my mother at a certain stage when we were about 19 or 20, and he was working in Coolmore Stud. And my mother was saying, "Now, Peter, what exactly is it you do down there?" Expecting him to say, and he said, I tickled the bollocks of horses.
He's a horse fluffer.
He was a horse fluffer. That's exactly what he was. That's exactly what he was in the stud.
Yeah.
And given that every go is about 20,000 quid or something for those horses.
That's true. Yeah, it's
an important job, the horse fluffer.
Yeah.
If you have...
Did he dress up, I wonder?
Well, listen, you weirdo. If you have strange jobs that you'd like to tell us on, hit us up on Twitter, my own account or John's account. Horse fluffing is pretty good.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
He was clearly good at it too.
He was very, very good at it. He's very good. I wonder, is there a sort of a hierarchy of horse fluffers? Yeah. Anyway, let us plow on and talk about millennials. And the reason I want to talk about millennials is because JM with us, like all of his generation, are stuck in this crazy idea of trying to find a house in this country. Now, John Collison was talking to us last week. You might have seen John Collison all over. Yep. You heard him here first on the David McWilliams podcast. And actually, the only place one of the Collison brothers has done a live interview in the world is our podcast, which is quite an achievement. And his company went from 35 billion when we talked to him to 92 billion last week.
That's because he talked to us.
But let me come back to the point. He was making the point, and we've been making it, that we need to fix the housing market because the housing market is the key to a decent lifestyle for the generation behind us.
Mm.
And if you look at what's happening right now, right, all JM told me, and this is a story that you will hear from lots and lots of people in their 30s, that right now the housing market is so dysfunctional in Ireland that you are demanded to go to sale agreed before you're allowed to see the house.
It's bonkers.
It's bonkers. It's
absolutely bonkers.
And I sent a little tweet last week about it and Twitter came back to me. Dozens of young people saying, I went to see a house. It's gone up by 50 grand from the asking price. I went to see a house. It's gone up by 60 grand. Even for the right to go and have a look at the thing, they're asking you to put down deposits, right?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
That's like buying a pair of shoes online. And you know, remember the shoes, the orthopedic shoes I bought the other day?
Yes, they were particularly fetching.
But it's like buying a pair of shoes without trying them on or without even seeing the right colour of it.
Or the pair of shoes says they'll cost you 50 quid and when you click buy, they cost 80.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, let's just talk about, because later on, we're going to talk to Simon Cooper about the future of cities. And what we're talking about in Ireland and everywhere in the Western world is largely an urban problem of urban prices. But my take on Ireland right now is that in the last year, the number of properties available to buy has fallen by 40%.
40%?
40%. Wow. Late 30s, okay. Early 40s, right? Why is this? Because at the start of the pandemic, the government said no viewing. So you can't view the house. So therefore, would-be sellers say, well, if there's no viewing, I won't put the house up for sale, particularly if they want to get a good price and move on, right? Mm. So what that means, John, is two things are happening in the Irish property market right now. One is rents are falling rapidly in Dublin, but prices are increasing rapidly. So as a rule of thumb, when rents are falling and prices are increasing, do not buy. Because rents falling means the underlying income for the asset that is property is falling. And when the underlying income is falling, the underlying price should fall too. Because obviously property has to have some relationship to the price, price and income. So what is happening to all the people in their early 30s, and the reason the early 30s is important, I'm going to come back to the most unfortunate year to be born in Ireland. is 1989, 1990. We'll go back to that in 2 seconds. I'll explain that. I'll explain that in a second. Right? Unfortunate timing. Those of you born in 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, unfortunate. And I'll explain why.
They're the years that I headed off to London, 88.
Which was fortunate for everybody around. But then I followed you, which is even unfortunate for you. But let us come back to that, right? What I'd say to you is, if you are looking for a house now, stop, desist, continue to rent, do not go into the market. And here is why, to use that great millennial expression. The supply has contracted. So there is no secondhand houses coming on the market because the people who want to sell secondhand houses realize there's no viewing, so they won't get a good price. Mm. Okay. Or that's what their psychology is telling them. Construction has been in lockdown for the last 8 months. So there's no new houses coming on. So supply has collapsed. However, demand is always there. And again, because people's incomes haven't been that badly affected in many sectors by COVID, there is demand there. And the banks are, believe it or not, trying to lend out to people with AAA covenants, right?
Mm.
So what you have is you have supply contracted and what is out there is shite. Let's call it shite, right?
Mm.
So you have no value for money, a very few amounts of very bad property out there, right? So what happens, unfortunately, in psychology is, you know, this idea that economists say, oh yeah, well, when the price goes up, the demand will go down.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. What happens in a market that is captured, where you need to buy a house or you want to buy a house or a flat because either you're having a kid or you're settling down or it's time to move on.
Yeah.
When you hear prices rising, like JM's generation, it doesn't prompt them initially to withdraw their demand. It prompts them to panic in the opposite way. And they think, my God, if I don't get in now, prices will be 70 grand more next year. So they bring forward demand.
It's a rerun of 2005, 2006.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they bring forward demand. So what you're having is not only do you have existing demand, but you have brought forward demand, all coming at a time when supply is contracted, which means prices go through the roof, which is why you get this bullshit. Like, you have to be sale agreed before you can see the effing house, right?
Yeah.
So the Dave McQueen's podcast advice to anybody now thinking of buying a house in that generation is desist. Step out of the market. I know it's going to be difficult. The country needs a buyer's strike. It needs a strike from buyers to say, we're not going to play this game. In 2 or 3 years, all the construction that was put on the back burner during COVID will be accelerated.
Yeah.
So there'll be lots more new apartments, lots more new developments. Once viewings get back, there'll be lots more secondhand houses and apartments coming on the market. So you would be crazy to buy right now. Now is probably the worst point of value for basically value for money for your euro that we've seen in ages.
Yeah.
So what I would say to particularly the early 30s, stop. Leave the market. Don't complete. Don't sign. Wait, because supply is going to come back on in a year or two. And if you can, and rents are falling, so take advantage of falling rents to get a better place to rent for the next 2 or 3 years, and don't go chasing this market upwards.
It's yet another reason to hurry up with the bleeding vaccines, so we can get back to that
vaccines,
point.
Vaccines, yeah. And I mean, what's very interesting about the pandemic was that, you know, most people, I think myself included, thought, okay, this time last year, pandemic, unemployment's going to rise, places are going to shut, house prices will fall.
Yeah.
But they didn't because of this strange interaction with supply and the strange interaction of psychology amongst people. Because people gossip, people have WhatsApp groups, people are talking to each other saying, my God, that thing went, I put down an extra 50 grand, it went, etc. So I think, chill out, don't buy, don't even look now, because what's on the market is brutal.
Yeah.
It's not only a seller's market, it's a brutal seller's market. And you don't want to be in that position.
So what kind of stuff is out there? Like, what kind of houses are available if nothing has been built at the moment?
Again, think of it, right? So Ireland's housing market is going through a massive transformation. People do not want always a three-bedroom semi in the suburbs, right? They want two-bedroom apartments, one-bedroom apartments, studios, etc. However, the only thing that's on there, if you think about it logically, there's no new builds. Nobody who doesn't have to sell is selling right now. So what is on is brutal quality. Okay. Mm. Now, my own thinking is it's only maybe probate houses. Older people have just died.
Right. Yeah.
Family want to sell because it's kind of like a windfall. And this is forcing, again, it's all about expectations. Younger people who are either in couples or single, the only thing they're being offered are older family homes built in the 1940s and 30s in areas that they don't want to live in.
Yeah.
So suddenly you've got not only a mismatch in terms of price, you've mismatched in terms of quality, you have a mismatch in terms of expectations, you have a mismatch in terms of location. The whole dynamic points to screwing the young person. So stay the hell, the market's so dysfunctional, get away from it, stay out of it. Rent, because rents are falling, and then chill out and wait until supply at some stage begins to change. And lots of people say, yeah, but we've been doing this for ages. But I'm just saying now is the worst time. The market is at its worst for buyers. So stay away.
Good advice.
But to come back to our issue about years of when you were born, John.
Go on, tell us.
So 1989, 1990, what were you listening to music-wise?
Ooh. Well, here's a little flavour from that era.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
The Iraqi army didn't make a retreat at all. It was a headlong, panicky flight into disaster.
There's the handshake we've all been waiting for, Monsieur Defago, Monsieur Cosette.
I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you, I make you laugh.
The nation holds its breath.
John, what's funny is the year you were born is unbelievably important to your subsequent economic challenges, right? If you're born around this period, let's say 1991, you're now 30, 31 at this stage, right?
Yeah.
You're born sort of like 89, 90, you're about 30, 31 now. In Ireland, your average birth of their first child is 31. It's increased dramatically since the 1960s, 70s, right? You tend to make these big decisions about buying houses or homes, settling down, creating your own space.
Yeah, that's the time. Yeah.
Coincident with your first kid. This is typical, right? Mm. So what it means is that babies born in 1990 are coming in through no fault of their own to the worst housing market that we've experienced, right? The worst housing market in terms of value. Maybe 2006, 7, 8 was as bad,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
So our advice to those people, there's lots more interesting things to do on a Saturday morning together than go looking at houses.
You mean like brunch?
And other stuff. So get out of the market. And again, think about our generation, born in the late 60s. We were born into a society that had no jobs and loads of houses.
Mm.
People who are born in the late 80s are born into a society, loads of jobs and no houses. And that's the way in which year you were born profoundly affects your economic outlook, your social outlook, your political outlook, your sense of yourself, your sense of the society.
Yeah.
And this is the Neil Howes idea, that generations think differently.
Yeah.
Because the background noise that affects the way in which they face society is differently. And the background noise for us was unemployment. The background noise for the late 80s people is ridiculously expensive housing. What I would suggest in the same way is we said, okay, unemployment in Ireland, let's go somewhere.
Well, we had the opportunity to go somewhere.
Well, we stepped out of the market and went elsewhere. What I would say to them is step out of the market now, rent for a while, value will get better, and don't do something stupid in the next 6 months.
So what was the best year to be born in then?
That's a very good question, John. I would say our periods were quite good, late 60s, I'd say early 70s, being born in Ireland. Mm. You know, the last thing you want, I look at my parents, born in the 30s in Ireland.
That was
a bad, bad, bad time, right?
It was.
Born in the 1880s, 1890s in Ireland, you ended up fighting the First World War.
Yeah.
Okay, and of course, born in famine years is
particularly
bad. But
born in the 30s, like our parents, I know, like my mum headed off to London in the 50s. My uncle headed off to the States, you know, so that was their kind of stepping out of the market, as it were.
JM doesn't know this, but I could have been Canadian. My parents both had visas to Montreal to go to work in Montreal.
Really?
In the late 1950s, early 1960s. And they were about to go and then they changed their mind. They were all set to go. And we could have been...
You could have been the Canadian.
I could have been the Canadian. A Quebecois, a French-speaking Canadian. Exactly.
So while value in itself is a good argument for now, we've been speaking about on and off about 15-minute cities and a kind of a transformation of urbanization in Ireland and around the world.
Yeah,
you know, Paris is transforming to this 15-minute city idea, well, I mean, and in Holland and stuff. So, you know,
but I mean, the pandemic has changed the whole thing. Online shopping, working from home, not commuting. I tell you what we'll do. Let's go and talk to Simon Cooper of the FT, who has a really fascinating and detailed take on the five big trends that we have to be aware of in urban living, urban economics, housing, transport, etc., and how that's going to impact on the city. And clearly, this will also impact on the price of city living. So let's go to Paris and talk to Simon. Simon Cooper, how are you doing?
Very well. Good to speak to you.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I haven't seen you for ages. Hopefully we'll see each other. If not Dawkey, definitely Kilkenomics, by which stage even the Irish will have vaccinated everybody. I believe it's going really slowly in France as well.
Yeah, they don't like vaccinating people. They think vaccines are very dangerous, etc. Much better just to catch COVID.
So that's what they're doing. That's the strategy, is it?
Yes.
No, but it is extraordinary. I mean, the vaccine hesitancy is amazingly high in France.
Highest in the world, according to the Wellcome Trust. Highest in the world in France.
The country of Louis Pasteur.
But they're also the country that had the huge outbreak of measles because they didn't do the MMR.
Really?
Yeah. And they had a huge outbreak a few years ago and quite a few
measles
kids
Measles is really
died.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let us talk about what the French are doing is the cities. I want to talk about the future of cities. You wrote a piece in the FT, fantastic piece, and you set it out in five headings. You said the cities are going to change, the office is going to change, neighborhoods are going to change, mobility is going to change, shops, homes, and gardens are all going to change. Take us through the changes you see coming in the city. Let's start with the office.
Well, there's been a lot of debate, is the office dead? You know, it's been a year of urban debates and of urban change like never before in my lifetime. And the conclusion of is the office dead debate is no, it's not dead. People will still need to go into the office maybe once, twice a week. So the office is going to shrink. You're going to have much, much less office space that you need. And you can imagine that if you're going to have a team meeting, say once a week, you know, every Monday morning your team gets together, you're not going to keep an office going. You will meet in a restaurant. You'll have brunch together. Or maybe once every 2 or 3 months, your team will go away to a country house for 4 or 5 days. Because you need to meet people, you need to exchange, but you don't need to do it every day, which creates the misery of commuting, which is about the unhappiest thing you can do in a developed Western country. So we have way too much office space, and that is going to shrink, and a lot of that will end up being turned into housing.
And tell me, so the office space shrinks, turns into housing, office rents then fall, commercial property, all that sort of stuff gets impacted quite rapidly.
Yeah, and so there's going to be losers. I mean, this is not a time to be owning commercial property or to be a bank that's been lending to a commercial property owner. So yeah, I mean, as they say in the trade, those people are going to take a haircut. But the winners are going to be people who could not afford to move into cities before because there wasn't enough housing. You know, Dublin is an example of that, but really all major cities in the Western world have become fantastically overpriced in the last 20 years. Now, once you start converting not just offices, but also many shops into housing, then you reduce that shortage.
I'm going to talk to you about shops in a minute because if this family is anything to go by, the amount of times the poor old dog is barking at all sorts of delivery blokes, usually blokes, all times of the day or night. I'll come back to that. You also write, I mean, again, you know, you spent your formative years in Holland. Holland seems to be a country that has twigged this urban dilemma before everybody else in terms of mobility, in terms of neighbourhoods, in terms of what the city is. Is it your Dutch upbringing that informs this sort of thinking?
I think so. I mean, I moved to Holland in 1976. So in the late 70s, early 80s, I lived in the country of the future because age 8 or 9, I cycled to school alone every day along protected bike paths, protected from cars. So did everybody in my class. You know, this is also the first country to legalize cannabis, to create gay marriage, to have euthanasia. So, you know, the Netherlands in those days invented the future of the world. And it was very successful with cities. Until the early 70s, there was quite a lot of cars killing people in cities. And there were a lot of protests by parents. And so Dutch cities, which had begun to allow the car, I mean, what happened in all these European cities from the 50s, you see it in Ireland as well, is the car, this new American thing, starts to take over. So until the 50s, quite a lot of people are cycling about. In Britain, bike sales peak in 1949, and then they start to fall. So we give our cities over to cars. The Dutch stopped that earliest in the early 70s. They only had 25 years of cars. You in Ireland, you've had, you know, probably 60 years of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, so bikes are going to take over because these cities, you know, if you think what Dublin was built for, it was built for people who went about on horses.
It's so absolutely true, yeah.
These streets that you have are good for horses, good for bicycles, not so good for a car. You know, so cars very quickly clog up a city. So we have to go back to the sort of 19th century or early 20th century city, which was a bicycling city.
So the car is almost the number one enemy, you would say, for urban reimagination.
Yeah, I was just walking around my neighborhood and just think of the space that is given over to cars. If you look outside your window now, you might see a whole road in which one or two cars are passing. So two people are using that immense space in front of your homes. And meanwhile, people are crammed inside these homes. So we've given our cities to cars, and we've even given our cities to unused cars. So parking spaces, often the car will sit there for 23 hours a day, maybe more if the owner doesn't use it every day. And a car stops people meeting each other because children can't go out. So people sit inside, you know, watching videos, and you don't meet people in a parked car typically. What the point of a city, the reason we live in these overpriced, dirty, overcrowded spaces is to meet other people, you know, to fall in love or to exchange ideas or to have friends. And cars stop us actually meeting people. So we have to get rid of them, and especially the parked ones. If you need a car, if you need to get the other end of town, well, you should take a kind of shared vehicle like an Uber, and that doesn't need to park hardly ever.
Look, I'm with you. I'm the man of the future. I don't even have a car. There you go. I am a living embodiment of the man of the future. But I am getting
a license.
But though. I am getting a Vespa. It's going to come. It's coming. It's coming. I've had my midlife crisis, Simon. I've bought a Vespa. I had one in my 20s, and I've gone on, and now we'll talk about that. The Vespa is an ongoing issue here because of the bleeding Brexit. It hasn't arrived. It's stuck somewhere in the UK. But anyway, in the article, you talk about neighborhoods. Let's talk about neighborhoods. You quote James Jacobs, who's the sort of the Uber thinker in this in urban thinking. Tell me about the future of neighborhoods.
So neighborhoods are going to become much more vibrant because in cities like Dublin or London, what had happened for 50 years, in London for longer, is people would leave their neighborhood in the morning, workers, and go into the center of town and then come back in the evening. So the neighborhood was largely empty during the day. Now, with much more working from home, which, as I say, is going to continue well beyond COVID, which is going to be the new normal, you're going to be in your neighborhood usually 24 hours a day. So if your home isn't big enough to work in, you'll rent a little bit of a co-working space on the high street, and then you'll pop out to do the shopping. You know, groceries are probably the last shopping that people will keep doing on a regular basis. You will pick up your kids, you will meet a friend, maybe all those things together. You'll have coffee with a friend while picking up your kids and doing shopping. And so the neighborhood becomes much more bustling, much more alive, which Jane Jacobs said is what you want. She says you want neighborhoods to be as mixed use as possible, work and play and living, partly because you have eyes on the street then. It's much safer, especially for women who feel often very unsafe in urban environments, if you have a lot of people just who are walking down the street who see what's going on. What you don't want, what kind of causes crime and the breakup of also any sense of community, is these empty streets, whether it's the empty suburban street, you know, think of suburban Dallas where you can walk around for an hour and not see anyone, or the empty street in an office neighborhood, which is deserted after 6 p.m.
That's interesting. She uses the word, and I think it's fascinating in terms of urban development, architecture, what, you know, the future. She uses the word trust. What does she say about trust?
Yeah, and you know, in our era of populism, we've also realized the breakdown of trust in politics and media has terrible consequences on our society. And Jane Jacobs says, in a mixed-use neighborhood where you're there all day doing different things, just kind of, you know, noodling about, going to the supermarket, yeah, you get to know the people in your neighborhood, if only by sight. Because you go into the supermarket and there's that lady who you've seen before, and you go to the coffee shop and you pick up your kids at the school. So you're constantly meeting people in all sorts of different ways and often talking to them. And so that creates trust. Whereas Jacobs, she says, maybe tongue in cheek, there was a study by academics of a kind of gray area neighborhood in Detroit who were looking to find what the social structure of this neighborhood is. And they conclude there is no social structure. Nobody knows each other.
I can see it happening already because we live out in a suburb of Dublin called Dunleary, which is, I mean, you've been here, you've been around Dalkey, Dunleary. Yeah. And what I've seen is, and again, it's beside the sea. So when people can get out, obviously they're coming down here, but there's a palpable sense of vibrancy emerging. You can really feel it in the last year, you know, and that ain't going to change.
Yeah. And once you're only going around Dunleary most of the time, you don't have to travel, you know, 15 miles somewhere. You do it on foot or you do it by bike. And that means that the neighborhood becomes much safer for children. And on a bike, you can meet people, actually. You wave at somebody who's passing. You stop for a little natter. So it's a much more social device. Also, of course, it's less dirty. And you're constantly exercising. You don't even realize it, but you're exercising. So that will be the neighborhood way of life. It will be like living in a village in the middle of or attached to a great city.
This sort of future, I mean, as I said, I can see it. I kind of felt it my first time or first times in Amsterdam, that sense of freedom. You rent a bike, you mooch around. There were lots and lots of Dutch people on the canal, sitting out, having chats. There was bars, there was restaurants. And also now we have, with online shopping, a change in what the street is going to look like. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so online shopping, when you don't go to the shop, but the shop comes to you, I mean, it's much greener because instead of 50 people driving to the supermarket, you have one supermarket van servicing those 50 houses. And then you have the issue of, you know, we see it now all the time. Now there's so many deliveries. You have these double parked vans everywhere because there's not enough parking spaces. So they clog up the road, you know, belching out petrol while they deliver your parcel. But then you're not there. So they have to come back, you know, 2 hours later. And so we need to make a city that's kind of safe for delivery. So every home is going to have a not just a letterbox, but a parcel box so that it doesn't matter that you're not there. They can leave this parcel, or it will be on the street. There'll be a kind of shared parcel delivery box on the pavement near your house, which you share with 10 or so other houses. And so delivering becomes much more efficient. And then also the remaining parking spaces, because we're going to get rid of most car parking spaces, those will be for delivery vans, and they can pay for it as well. Because right now what Amazon does is it doesn't pay the city anything. It's not paying Dublin anything, typically, when they deliver your parcel, because they're just double parking and running into your house. And they're not paying for the space they're using.
Okay, so, and of course, then people can move in, because what I've noticed is, you know, the main street here, and again, I'm using Dunleary, but everybody can imagine their own little neighbourhood, wherever you're listening to this podcast, you can imagine, you know, has an obsession with having shops on the main street as opposed to people living on the main street. And of course, that amplifies this sense of emptiness after 6 o'clock, amplifies the sense of just one unique view. Do you think that cities will have to encourage, because at the moment it's quite hard to change from retail to residential, planning-wise, in Ireland. Do you think this is going to have to something that's going to have to accelerate very quickly, because people are going to have to live in these shops, one that once were shops could now become apartments?
Yeah, I mean, some of them will become apartments. Some of them on your local high street will become co-working spaces because, you know, even if you can work from home, some of the time you want to go out and see other people and the kids come home and then it's impossible to work. So you'll rent a co-working space occasionally. And you also want a life on the street still. If everything is an apartment or a coffee shop, because coffee shops will thrive in this new world, so you need coffee shops and co-working spaces to create life in the neighborhood. But we do have too many shops because if you look at your local high street, it's left over from the pre-internet era. Of course, until 1995, you did have to go out to buy everything, and now you don't anymore. The high street is already shrinking, but what's going to shrink even more are shops in the wrong places. You know, the one little shop on the roundabout that nobody can quite see what the point of it is. That shop is going to die. Shopping malls are dying. Shopping malls out of town are going to become housing. Some of them would work very well as old people's housing. And then little bits of the food court will survive, will become better. And you might even, if it's really good, you might even want to go out there for dinner with, you know, your family. So it'll be a mix of eating and living.
And just before we close down, you've also touched on homes and gardens. Again, Dublin is a city with such an absence of gardens, parks, and particularly small gardens and parks. You know, we've got one huge thing called Phoenix Park, but it's a big park, just one. We have very few small ones and very, very few public gardens in comparison to other cities. What do you think the home is going to look like and the sort of the amenity structure of gardens and cities?
I think what you want is a little, a park doesn't have to be big. It just needs to be near you. And it needs to be so near you that a child can go out alone. So I grew up in the Netherlands with autonomy because I could get on my bike. And, you know, my parents didn't know where I was. I was going around all the time from primary school age. And nowadays, of course, we as parents, when your kids are under 12 or so, you're completely attached to them because you can't let them go anywhere because they might get hit by a car. So what you want is you want to turn the parking space on your doorstep, the two parking spaces, into a little mini park, you know, with a swing or a slide or a little football goal. And then your kid and all the other kids in the neighborhood can go out there and meet each other and play with each other without having to cross the road. So you're going to get those green spaces everywhere, also communal gardens. You know, in Dublin, you do have a lot because you all live in homes, you know, which is a problem in itself because it creates sport, but at least you have gardens. But in Spain, 2/3 of people live in apartments. They don't have gardens. Gardens are great for mental health. They're also great for meeting other people. So in Barcelona, they're creating rooftop gardens where everyone in your apartment building shares this garden. You can go up and create social networks, often for people who don't have them at all. So that's going to become much more common. I think the home is going to, you know, in the big enough homes, there's going to be an office that's going to be built in, and the kind of 19th century parlor, etc., has obviously died over time, and those spaces will become offices for people who live big enough. I think the home might develop to have a soap sanitizer as a kind of standard fitting when you walk in. You walk in, and before you shake hands or kiss, you do a little soap up, because COVID is going to become endemic. You know, it's not going to disappear. It's going to become less deadly because we'll be vaccinated. And also, we've learned this winter we can get rid of flus just by washing our hands and not, you know, touching people all the time when not necessary. So there'll be that soap sanitizer, and we also will have balconies as a kind of essential feature of the house, says David DeJay, because nobody ever again wants to contemplate a period when they can't actually be outside, which some people experienced in lockdown.
Simon, just before we go, who's going to be first out of the blocks with this type of city? What countries are leading the charge here?
Well, the countries are already sort of there. The cities are Amsterdam and Copenhagen. Those are really the models for the city that I'm describing. Paris is moving there very, very quickly. So they've been laying bike lanes like mad all over the city in the last year. They're going to start creating little urban forests because you want less concrete, especially with more heat waves. So Paris is going to turn the forecourt of Hôtel de Ville, the town hall, into a little urban forest. So all cities are moving very, very fast. You know, New York is now routinely opening school playgrounds at all hours. Anyone can, you know, come there at any time and hang out. So this is a kind of global move. It doesn't seem to me that Dublin is at the forefront of it.
No, I think that was a very, very tactful and tasteful way of telling us, no, we're not, because we have, I think it's fair, a serious, serious lobby that wants to remain building homes as we have done for years. It's a developer lobby. It's also a way of thinking. We haven't really grasped this just yet.
Can I just say one thing about Dublin before you push me away? Dublin, people think they need cars, which I understand. What they really need is electric bikes. An electric bike, you can do 15 miles an hour. You know, if you're not fit or if you're going up a hill, you just turn on the motor. It only costs about 800 euros. So it's much, much cheaper than running a car. And for most trips within Dublin, you know, how often do you go more than 8 miles? Well, that's 30 minutes on an electric bike. And so that would make the city so much more habitable, make everybody much healthier. And it would give you all a massive pay rise, because instead of spending 30,000 euros on a car, you're spending 800 on an e-bike.
We will conclude there. That is an upsell for bike. No, listen, Simon, that was excellent. Listen, thank you so much.
Cheers, guys.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Do you know what, Mac? I think some of the ideas that Simon was talking about there and some of the other ideas we discussed about 15-minute cities in previous podcasts, there's an element of bollocks to it.
Oh, listen to you, car man.
No, I'm anti-car as well, not quite listen, as bad as you and your Vespa and your...
Listen, and am, your I walking? Am I walking?
And your bus pass.
I know. Well, listen, I'll be for my Zimmer frame as well.
No, but there's something just a little bit middle-class utopian about all of this. You know, look at it this way.
Yeah, it's, no,
I love the idea of a 15-minute city. You know, having a strong community where you stroll down the street on your bike and you grab your coffee and you say hi to a neighbor called Fred and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you go to work that is within 15 minutes. That's not possible for many people. Many people's work is over the other side of the city and they're living on this side of the city because this is what they can afford.
No, I understand.
So it's not possible for most people.
Well, I think with remote working, most people in the Western world live and work in services cities, cities where our work is service. It's kind of desk-bound work. And I'm not sure it's impossible to conceive of a future where that idea of commuting for 50 miles or 40 miles is regarded as kind of ridiculous, right? If you have the infrastructure, the broadband infrastructure, the working from home infrastructure, I think if we've learned anything from the pandemic is that we suffered from a really collective absence of imagination in the way we lived.
I get that.
Over the last while.
I do get that.
I think that Simon's saying, you know, the car lobby is huge in terms of its influence on urban transport and planning, and in every country, therefore, regional transport and planning. Mm. So we have based our societies around a piece of metal with wheels in it. And that has completely and utterly jaundiced what's possible. Well, you know, and I take your point. Look, his point is like neighborhoods will become much more significant as opposed to dormitory towns,
sure,
right? And those neighborhoods will have their own organic way of developing. I think he's right. I think what we're talking about is if you look at the history of urbanism, if you go back to the Greeks, John.
Let's go back to the Greeks.
The Greeks started with this idea, the center of the city is the agora, the marketplace, the place where people come to buy and sell,
sure,
not just stuff, buy and sell ideas, buy and sell notions, politics as well, right? And then you get the monetization of the urban world. And cities have always had this layered, cosmopolitan, liberated feel to them. It is only in the latter part of the 20th century that we imposed on city the will of the car. And that profoundly changed the way cities are.
Yeah.
So now we can reverse that. Like we're going back and we're talking about Florence, John.
Indeed.
You know? Like if you look at medieval Florence, right, you had a system of artisans and guilds and workers and immigrants and people coming and going. But the city itself was the hub. Now, like I think he's right. I think it's going to change.
Okay. I get all that. However, all our cities were designed and built in an era before the internet.
Yes.
So now you're talking about, and rightly so, we have a new way of working vis-a-vis we're working from home remotely. Yeah. And the only way we can do that is because we're all connected.
Yes.
Via the internet. And that's great. And that works now. But the city itself was designed way before this. So it's a bit like, as Simon said there, Dublin was built for the horse.
Yeah.
and we've gradually changed that, but we still have those narrow little
streets,
windy streets.
Should not have any cars on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
They should become, I mean, they should become, cities become entertainment, leisure, places to hang out, these sort of places, plus places to live. Like, think about shops, right? Mm. Think about how much money we are spending extra in shops to pay the rent. I come back to land all the time. You just were going to buy hard drive. Give me the numbers.
Yeah, for a 2 terabyte hard drive, it was a shade under 500 quid.
In Currys and PC World
in,
here?
Yeah.
In the shop, the retail price?
Yeah.
And how much is it on Amazon?
It was, with conversion and stuff, it was about 250. So pretty
half
much
price.
Half price, yeah.
So shops are over. And the reason it's half price in Currys and PC World, you got to pay rent.
Yeah.
Huge amount of rent. And they put up their own markup. Now, think about that all around in every shop, right? Most people will think, remember we did a thing on shopping a while ago, the shops will be just like, almost like websites. There'll be like a web page.
Yeah,
you'll
yeah.
go in and
like
say,
a brochure.
I would like that. Yeah, I would like that. And it's going to be an experience and all that sort of stuff. But my sense is that we can be really optimistic about the future of cities because what Simon Cooper has suggested is, I think, very attractive. Jane Jacobs, who is the sort of Dion of urban thinking, her idea of eyes on the street was really fascinating for me. In the last 2 weeks, my daughter, my wife, lots of women I've spoken to have been angry and scared about their safety.
My girls too.
And if you talk to any woman, they will always tell you they will walk down the street with people on. They will always avoid the street, which is empty and dark. If we create living cities for 24-hour streets that different people are on the street at different times, these are much safer places. What terrifies women is the dark place where there's nobody around. Was there much, much more dangerous? The whole city that we have built around the car is a dangerous city because it's a city that closes, that certain areas close down, that's not alive, that people don't live in, people commute and they leave at 6 o'clock, then the whole vibe of the city changes. Dublin's like that, you know, the whole vibe changes at night. It's a totally different place. Imagine that city with what Jane Jacobs said, eyes on the street. So I'm protecting you. You're protecting me because we're all there together. It's a much safer place.
Actually, it reminds me of LA. I spent quite a while in LA and that talking about a city that's designed for the car.
And there's dark streets and there's empty zones.
People don't walk the street full stop because if you're going out to get a pint of milk, you drive, you know? And there's no alternative.
Yeah, you drive and there's no public transport. But the point is there's no people in the street. Actually, I'll tell you a story about America. You know Cathal Coughlan of Micro Disney?
Yes.
The band?
Yeah.
They have a great song called Only Losers Get the Bus. And it was, Coughlan was in LA and he was waiting at a bus stop. Right?
Yeah.
And he was obviously the only white person because it's only poor people get the bus in America.
Yeah.
And he was waiting at the bus stop looking very conspicuously white and a kind of a jerk freaking jock arrives up, rolls down the window buzzes down the window of his Corvette and just says, only losers get the bus and then whored off.
And he wrote a song about it.
But living cities are safe cities, are vibrant cities. And they are our future.
I'm not stupid. I'm a man.
Take first. Only losers take first. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.